We chant the Metta Sutta together. Usually Bob leads this. He's an old time.
Go for Bob. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. There can be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them nod to the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, upwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to his excuse, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
So what do we do here? Anyways, three monks here. Myself, I'm Ajahn Santuti, and Ajahn Jaya, and Ajahn Sukakama. little do you know, there's a monastery in Kelmscott, right in your neighborhood. So we've so if you ever get bored, if there's no Monday, Tuesday night classes with any monks, you can come see us, because we always come see you. But there's a monastery there, a full-on bhikkhu monastery where we keep the rules really well, and where we're going to spend the next 3 months for the rain retreat. But we're always there all year round. So, you know, if you're looking for a Buddhist place to go to, learn a bit about Dhamma, spend time with the monks, you can just come and visit. And usually a good time to visit is for the meal time, because you get to see the monks and you get fed. What a bonus, eh? Well, anyways, I think the details of the monastery is out in the back. So yeah, if you're interested, just have a look. And just tonight, so myself and Jaya and Sukakama, we got invited here just to have a chat, really. If anybody has any questions to ask, so that's what the whole idea is not to sit down and just talk for half an hour on meditation, but now is your time to have an opportunity to really ask questions, any old questions, whatever you like. What is your shoe size? What do you eat for breakfast? How do you meditate? All those kinds of questions. So yeah, we'll leave it up to you.
All the curly ones are in the box.
So for the people that do, would you like to explain a bit about Rain Retreat?
Okay, yeah. Okay, so for the newbies. So I'm sure you come here to learn how to meditate. Yeah. So basically, the Rain Retreat is a time where the monks we try to cut off as many activities as possible. So as you can see outside of the Rain Retreat, the monks are more involved in teaching. So we travel to like Armidale and sometimes we're going to Dhammaloka, and also we have a Monday night class as well in our monastery in Kelmscott. But all that is basically shut down for the 3 months. So in a sense, outside of the rains, the monks spend time like serving the lay people. And when the lay people, they come to the monastery and they have questions to ask, we're just happy to help them. And one of the reasons why lay people come to the monastery is because you probably don't know, we can't cook by ourselves. And we don't have any money, so we can't call Uber Eats. So that's also gives lay people like yourself the opportunity to this word in Buddhism, like make merit. Yeah, to give without like expecting anything in return, and basically to make good karma. Yeah, and so it's sort of like the idea of making good karma is sort of like you have to like change your perception when it comes to this idea. It's sort of like sometimes you think, oh, some people may think, oh, the monks are living in the monastery and they're lazy, they don't want to do anything, they just sit down and get fat, they don't work. And the people come and feed them, that is so unfair. And that's a type of perception that some people can develop. But the idea is just changing your perception of just having that idea of being able to help. You know, for instance, like volunteer work, giving to people who need it. And even though we look healthy and plump and well fed, we need your food. We need your generosity. Otherwise, we can't survive. And it is true. Our lifestyle is basically given to us by the support of everyday people. Everyday people give money to the monastery so we can develop it, to like build kuti, to build like cabins for monks to meditate in, to pay the electrical bills, to even purchase the land, because as monks, when we become a monk, the whole idea is to give up everything, all our possessions, our credit cards, our cars, our careers, and just to give up everything and just to be able to live simply in a monastery. So yeah, a lot of our lives do depend on the generosity of lay people, and we are very very grateful for it, like seriously grateful. And when and that's why we do our best to just to give back, and just from giving back, you get good feelings, from doing good things. And that's as simple as that. And there's no like magical reason why you have to give back. You give back because you know that it actually has a good feeling associated with it. So for the next 3 months, we're just going to chill out. We're going to chill and relax on the meditation couch. Okay. Question. Question. Yes. Huh? Oh, is that a restaurant?
Yeah, it's a vegan.
Huh?
We can't hear the question.
Okay, hang on.
Do you eat Anna Lakshmi in Elizabeth King?
It's
a vegan restaurant.
No.
I thought that.
How many stars?
5 stars.
Ooh, yeah. That must go. No.
I thought it was the monks.
Volunteer people. Is that the one on the corner? It used to be the one on the corner,
yeah,
right?
No, not the bridge.
This is on the water.
Oh, yeah.
Go take the ferry, go to Rottnest.
To Rottnest,
it's
yeah.
It's on the water.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
and,
yeah.
Run by an organization. I think it is in Hong Kong.
Hong Kong?
Yeah, but it has branches in many places.
Okay.
And they volunteer to cook only
vegan, vegetarian meals.
And it's by donation.
Yeah.
The people took advantage of all of that to the level that I heard from a friend of mine. Did you see that place where you can eat for a dollar?
Yeah.
I thought, that is the wrong way to say it. Because it's a donation. You know, you just offer whatever it is coming out. And not a dollar, you know, I mean.
$10
Whatever you want to. Yeah. As if you're going to go out and eat this very good meal, as much as you like, you can come back twice or three, whatever. Yeah. But for a
dollar? It's not like Kelsey. It's not like Kelsey. It's free. Yeah. Cool. All right.
Okay. Okay. This is a curly question for the month. It says, what happens to really bad people with... You got to keep that really close to your mouth.
What happens to really bad people with regards to reincarnation?
Whoa.
Any really bad people here? Okay.
Must be a warm worried one.
That's right. Must be verified. No. Okay. What Agarbhav said about we've lived in rebirth, like many lives, a series of lives, one after the other, and the good fortune and the bad fortune that we have in that life is considered to be just from actions in the past. But the really important thing to understand is that we're talking about actions here. Good and bad action, but not good and bad people, because everyone's got a bit of everyone does a bit of good, everyone does a bit of bad in different in different amounts, and I think that it's nice what Adrian Brown says.
I bet Pol Pot's mum thought he was a really nice
boy. Oh yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, I mean there's that classic letter written by Hitler to his mum, and it just shows keeping this person that caused so much suffering to so many people. Even he had love for his mother, at least. So even the worst kind of the person who's on the most bad stuff, even they will know they're good. At the end of your life, hope you've done lots and lots of good karma, so you don't have to worry too much. And Yeah, I think the Buddha was pretty used to say that, you know, if you keep doing good things, and that includes being generous, being kind, and being helpful, and putting up with JR in the monastery without wanting to kill him, Trudy pretty well, Trudy does pretty well. those are like the good seeds, and they'll result in good results. So basically, we don't see people as good or bad. We don't see people as good or bad. Only action. So you don't have to worry about all those actions of the past that you've done, and all the actions of the future. Just have to worry about what you're doing in the present moment, and to just make sure what you're doing here now is for your benefit and for the benefit of others. Just don't do your best. Nobody's perfect. Just, don't worry. You'll have many chances over and over again to get it right. It's a bit like Groundhog Day, you know. Does anyone watch Groundhog Day?
Yeah.
That's a good movie. That's a good Buddhist movie. Right? every morning he wakes up and he lives the same day over and over again. Just every time he lives that day, he's got a little bit more wisdom because he's done it before. And this is Bill Murray. I don't know what the character was, but he's a fantastic actor. There's all those really crazy, cheesy comedies early on, and then made some quite good films. Rushmore. Did anyone see Rushmore? That was pretty cool. Yeah. Anyway, so Groundhog Day. So you wake up every morning, and because you've done it before, you practice, and you just give it everything you got, and each day gets close to perfection. It's a good way to live your life. Do that, I'm very, very happy. Okay, all right.
Very good.
Okay.
No idea.
What, the really, really bad people?
You shuffled away from that bit. You're a bit political there, avoiding confronting
questions. Go on, lay it off. Well, I'm not going to do the fire and brimstone thing. I think there's one sutra where the Buddha goes into it. In Buddhist cosmology, we call it Buddhist cosmology, you know, there's sort of like different levels of existence, and the highest realm is sort of just very, 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 very pure happiness and equanimity to, so what they call like the lower realms. Animals and ghosts and those nasty realms where you have lots of suffering. It's all sort of like in this realm thing, you've got people in very, very many different states. Some are very, very happy and living really easy lives and everything comes to them. And maybe there's some people who are not so fortunate, you know. And they've got a lot of suffering in their life. And I find that it's often not all bad. Some people have, you know, mental illness or physical illness or something like that, but then in other aspects of life, you know, they're very, very, very well off. So that's kind of considered the way it is in the human realm, a mixture of happiness and suffering. So I guess the other realms just go off in different directions, more and more happiness or more and more suffering. Yeah. So officially, yeah, in the sutras of Buddha don't say, if you make a whole lot of really bad karma, then you're gonna have some suffering in the next life. In your next life. But possibly in this life too, you know. Sometimes I don't know about instant karma. I know gentlemen, John Lennon sang a song about instant karma, but generally it's something that happens in the future. Like you do an action and it's a kind action and it leads to the benefit of yourself and for others, and that will always, no matter what, ripen sooner or later in something good. If you do something that's bad for yourself, bad for others, causing harm intentionally, then that'll particularly right, but always in a bad way. That's the sense of the war of karma. But I'm going to super reference if you're going to go into really, you know, get really into. Huh? What? Well, I don't know. The Buddha goes on and on about, you know, well, it's really hard to come up with a similar to just how bad hell is. Well, let me try. And it all goes into the sort of fire and brimstone sort of thing. And then it talks about the heavenly realm. It's just so hard to find an example, you know, or a simile to explain how happy that is. But I'll try it. And I'm like, what? You get a flying horse? Seriously, it's incredible. So, you know, there's the horse treasure, you know, there's horse flying around there. It's very strange. But it's not my idea of a good time. I think if I, you know, made all that good karma to get to heaven and I get a flying horse, you know, would have disappointed. So it's always presented as a sort of simile, you know. You've just got that whole spectrum from really, really happy to really, really unhappy and suffering, pain and lots of stuff. And it all relates to action. It all relates to action. So do a good action, that'll ripen happiness. So if you're in a really bad place, do a good action, and then you know, it'll still ripen in happiness in the future. There's always hope. Okay. There you go.
Just one again on the same thing. In the Jewish tradition, that child pays for the sins of the fathers.
Oh, right, okay.
So
yeah.
How does the Buddhism treat that?
Okay, so we're getting quite deep into Buddhism here tonight, which is fine. Maybe ask questions. Normally we keep it quite secular, but I'm quite happy to answer. I think there's no in Buddhism there's no sort of you are heir to your own karma. You own your own karma. It's just you. It's your own action. Yeah. There's no sort of group karma. There's no sort of, you know, karma that belongs to a group of people, or you get the karma, the results of the karma of someone else. That's just as it's described, this doesn't happen. No. Hi. Have you guys been a bit lighter?
Just to finish off.
Yeah.
There's a place in Thailand called Bang Sen.
Oh yeah.
And there's a temple in there, and it's probably got 2 acres of statues.
Oh wow, okay.
All about the realms.
Ah, okay, yeah.
And it's like a 000 horror film.
Yeah.
Like huge big statues, small ones. And there's every horrific deed you can think of.
Yeah.
And then at the top, then there's a guy with the book.
So I think definitely there's a style of iconography in certain temples where I like to
quite explicit,
graphically
depict
all the horrible things that'll happen to you if you're a naughty boy.
Yeah.
Or a naughty girl. But it's just a way of decorating temples.
I have a question.
Good, yeah.
Questions
are good.
What do you eat?
What do we eat?
Absolutely
anything.
We
eat whatever people bring to people. So, what do we have today? We had Thai food. Thai food. And
Thai Cambodian.
Thai
Cambodian.
Cambodian food, and sometimes we have Sri Lankan food.
Sure.
And sometimes we have some Western food as well. Sometimes we have KFC.
Pizza.
Yeah. Chips.
Have we got a quick question?
Yeah.
What's your view on eating meat?
Huh? What's your view on eating meat,
Sanjuri? My view.
It says one of your 5 precepts, do not kill.
Oh.
What's your
okay.
view on eating meat?
The way I live, I don't really make it too complicated.
Yeah.
So in our tradition, the way we've been trained is we just eat whatever people give us. So a part of that is some people do serve meat for the monks to eat, and the reason why they do that is
when you talk about karma and intention, when it comes to there's a difference between cooking meat and killing an animal. So yeah, you can see that if you go out and you intentionally like kill a cow or kill a pig, it's different to going to the shop and actually buying it. And the Buddha did say that if a monk does know if a certain meat that has been killed for him to eat, then the monk cannot eat it. Yeah. But that's like, just put it simply, you know, that's how I've been like raised as a Buddhist monk, and it's sort of like you know, you have great monks in the past and they eat meat and they, you know, they become enlightened. Yeah, you know what I mean? So one monk said something very wise. It's more important to be mindful of what comes out of your mouth than what you put in your mouth. Because people be yeah, because people just get caught up over these things.
My grandfather used to have the saying that says the wise man knows how to keep his own counsel.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it's time to meditate. So you're beginners, right? So yeah, meditated before? A little bit? A little bit. So basically we're just sitting down for half an hour. I think JR can give the guided meditation. I gave one last week.
Okay.
Yeah. So we just sit down and close your eyes and relax basically and just flow with the moment. Flow with the moment.
Okay. I said we dispense with the headset now, which is because it seems to, the old headset seemed to cut out after 3 minutes of silence. So, as we sit here for half an hour, there'll be time, so I won't talk for maybe more than 3 minutes. And be all this silence. And now, time to relax. So, to get started, make sure that the clothing is comfortable. If you need to loosen anything, loosen it. If you need to tighten anything, tighten it. Just relax. So, if you're not sure about what meditation is all about, you're a bit new to it. So, essentially, we're just trying to relax and enjoy a comfortable silence. Now's the most important time. And the most important person is yourself. With your eyes closed, can't hear people talking, except me. Nothing much to smell, or taste, or touch. Just relax in the present moment. And just to start with, give yourself a bit of loving kindness. Say to yourself, I'm good enough. I can try 30 minutes with nothing to do. No job, no responsibility. It's time to chill. Be kinder to yourself. Ways letting go. Letting go of your thinking mind. To accept it the way it is. Just like a snow globe that's been shaken up by all the days of it. You just pop it down, put it down on the table beside you, put it in your lap, and down the ground. Gradually those snowflakes drift to the bottom. Up to your mind. Give them kindness. Let them be. Eventually they'll settle down. Remember, there's no real magic to meditation. All you have to do is pretty much nothing. So, just remember that as meditation goes, it's there that way. Always sitting up. I've always had that contentment. Whatever is happening in the mind. gradually, gradually, meditation is a process where things start to fade away. Everything you've been doing today, up until now, fading away. Everything you might have to do later on, none of your business. So gradually fade away. goes on into the past and future, near to the inevitable and meditation. And then to be very kind, very gentle, be mine, back to the present, back to the here and now. Always remember this important thing. Amen. You just to be content with the way things are. Yeah.
this is good enough.
Let's feel that calm and peace. Feel your chest. Feel it down through your body. Your belly and through the legs and the toes. Spread in the body, relax along with the mind. This is the way we regain the energy we lead throughout the day, throughout busy lives, flickering quite closely in the meditation. Just remember, really good thing to do. Make one calm. Kind and gentle. Just realize that this will rub off on all the people you associate with in your day to day life. It's very good for your own mind. It's very good for the happiness of you. Thank yourself for taking this.
So, any questions about meditation? John Arato can answer them. Because he gave the guided meditation.
Yeah, so it was supposed to be my job tonight to do the class, but I think yesterday at the Monday night group we got invited to bring all three of us, because all three of us came yesterday. So, in questions about meditation, I know sometimes when you when I do a bit of guided meditation, it can be a bit it's always random. I try and say whatever comes to mind that I think would make mind more peaceful.
You got a question?
We've got a question.
You know, when you meditate, and I know you can't keep your mind still, but sometimes a thought might come up from 30, 40 years ago. And so is there a reason why those thoughts might just pop into your head? Something you might haven't thought about for a long, long time.
Okay, so you're asking about thoughts that come up in the mind, unbidden. Sometimes...
Not even thinking about it.
It's almost as if... It's almost like a process of association without association. Often when you're sitting in meditation, and something will come up that you haven't thought about for years and years. Well, that's just kind of normal. I guess generally, if it takes away from the present moment, the best thing to do is probably just to acknowledge it and just let it go. There's no need to sort of psychoanalyze yourself but it's cool. There's all sorts of interesting stuff happens in meditation, and it's not just about sitting down and all the thoughts just suddenly disappear. And sometimes some of the thoughts on the left are some of the most interesting, and you just have a bit of patience and let go even of the interesting thoughts and stuff. But it's not a problem, it's just a normal process of mind. A lot of meditators worry a bit about the thinking mind, and although we're sort of inclined towards letting go of all thoughts, even abiding in a mind that might not have any thoughts like minutes at a time, that sort of thing. But that's just a gradual process of the snow globe, the snow globe simile that I stole from Santucci because he used it last time. These thoughts, they do gradually settle down. So you'll have first of all, sort of 50% of the snow will be down, and then eventually 75%, and then get closer and closer to 100% silence. And this is a really good practice. The more you can focus on those spaces between the thoughts, it's a nice trick that Ajahn Brahm likes to teach. These are sort of the preliminary steps before we take up a meditation object like the breath or meditation. Yeah, but sometimes, you know, some pretty strange stuff comes up in the mind that you haven't thought about for years and years. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And all sorts of interesting stuff happens. I think there's the story of Ajahn Chah. He used to, so Ajahn Chah, for those who don't know, was the teacher of my teacher, so Ajahn Brahm. He trained in Thailand, in the northeast of Thailand in the early 70s through to the 80s before coming to Australia to set up Bodhinyana Monastery. And Ajahn Chah was a really cool guy. Some great stories. So he would sometimes, you know, he'd just wander around in the forest, and a lot of the monks of that era were just simple rice farmers, and nothing more complicated in their life but managing their water buffalo and that sort of thing. But they'd go off into the forest and spend a lot of time out there meditating. But sometimes Ajahn Chah would sit by like a, what they call a still forest pool. And sometimes he wouldn't even meditate, he'd just sit there with his, just sit there very, very still, with his eyes open. And what he found was, you know, this is the jungles of, before the whole, most of Thailand turned into rice paddies and cities and mega cities and that sort of thing. Back then, you know, he said, the longer he'd sit there, the more still he'd be. These animals would come out of the forest to drink, and to drink at the pool, because that's what the animals have to do. They eat and drink like normal. But he found that, kind of like you're saying, these very interesting thoughts come up. He said the longer you sit there very still, these very strange animals would come out of the forest. You know, animals you'd never see normally, you know, just living in the village. Now, being a farmer, and he said, yeah, sometimes, you know, after a long time, if you're very, very still, some fantastic beasts would come out of the forest to drink at the pool. And he said, any movement at all, those animals would just disappear, and you'd never see them again, they'd run off into the forest. So, yeah, it's kind of like a simile to the mind, you know. The more still you are, the more beautiful the experience is. You have meditation, and it's a really, really long process, starting with, you know, just sitting down and, you know, just trying to let go of your shopping trips and your your interactions with co-workers and neighbours and all that sort of stuff. So just letting that settle down first, you know, the first flakes of snow to settle down in the snow globe. after a while, you know, you might come across some fascinating thoughts, but after you let that go, you have this very strange feeling, because we're so used to the thinking mind. We think that when the thoughts stop, that the mind stops. And when you meditate, you find that's not the case. You know, you have these beautiful experiences, but there's no words. There's no words in the mind. It's more of a an emotional thing, right? Mm-hmm. So you into the realm of more of feeling rather than thinking. You know, you start to watch the breath, and the breath is sort of, it's all right. It's not so bad. You know, you just have the patience to sit with the breath for 5-10 minutes, half an hour, and by the end of that, if you can stay with the breath, it actually becomes quite beautiful. Ajahn Brahm talks about the beautiful breath, the delightful breath, to the point that in that settles down, it becomes very, very still. I think we've been to some very, very deep meditation. The point being that as the meditation practice progresses, and it's very much like Groundhog Day. okay, here we go. Sit down again. Here we go. And it's a very, very interesting, beautiful state to all our stuff over time.
I feel like I had a really peaceful meditation, and all of a sudden, thought from nowhere.
Yeah, where did that come from?
Yeah.
Well, probably the mind's gone out looking for it.
So,
just unconsciously. You just have to let it go. Anyone else have any questions? Yes.
It's not a meditation question.
That's okay.
It's you two learned venerable monks have been here several times.
Three venerable. Oh, yeah. Well, tell us.
For our guest.
Yes.
He hasn't. It seems a shame to disturb him, but he could tell us his story.
Okay. So,
if possible.
I was just going to say. So, venerable Sukha, come on. But they're just a little bit interested in your story. So,
where are you from?
Why you become a monk?
Yeah,
where are you from? Why you become a monk?
I'm from Cambodia.
The door closed, I did.
Otherwise they can't hear you.
The cheap seats can't hear
that. I'm from Cambodia. my temple not far away from the Phnom Penh. Phnom Penh is the capital of city in Cambodia. But my temple not far away from the city, about 15 kilometers from the city.
Have you been here long?
I have been here 6 years.
Then there must be more story than.
Yes, I think it's good for the Ajahn Santuti and Ajahn Jaya. They come to stay with me. I can practice English. I try to push myself to speak English. Before I stay in my temple, I speak like my own language, like the Cambodian language, to communicate with my supporter in Cambodia. But
so how many Cambodian monks?
It's not only me.
No, in where you are, in Kamskot.
In Kamskot, only one me.
Just you?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry, come and destroy your peace.
And I'm lucky too. Lauren,
he's
guy is there. He's a teacher. He always come to my temple every Monday afternoon. He teach me like English, how to pronunciation and how to follow like the Ajahn Brahm book, like open the door of your heart. But some story is I'm very interesting, like because I try to learn more about the vocabulary. Some words I don't understand, he can explain me about and give the example, I can understand more.
When did you become a monk?
2018.
Yeah.
12 years ago.
No, 11 years, not 12.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Lauren,
one month after me.
Yeah?
We're both about 10 years.
You must have been very young when you joined up, very young.
Hello.
You're a young person.
How old were you when you ordained?
28. When I become a monk is 28 years old.
What did you do before you were a monk?
Yeah. Before a monk, get a job, like that's the same question in the last night.
Just say what you said last night.
Yeah. Yes. I studied in archaeology, but when I work in like the teacher, like teacher history in economy.
Good.
Okay.
I have a time.
Yeah.
Any more questions? Go on.
What's the difference between temples in Australia and temple in Cambodia?
Uh-huh. But in Cambodia, my temple, some the monk is from the poor family to become a monk. They want to study Pali and like the general knowledge, like the mathematics, geography, something like this, because they can opportunity to go to study in school, because it's a poor family, they want to become a monk and get a knowledge from the Buddhism and generally. But in here it's like have a good country for have opportunity to practice meditation. But in Cambodia have also but some monastery they practice like in Australia, like the Thailand and traditional, it's the same. Thailand and Laos, India. But the like practice meditation is, I think, sometimes different technique, sometimes the same technique, like we focus on the breathing result.
Do you have family in Cambodia?
Yes, I have my family.
Brothers, sisters?
I have four brothers and one sister. Yes, my brother, last year he just passed away. He became a man also. Yes.
I imagine the difference between Cambodian Buddhism and Theravada would be too hard to explain. It's
different from...
Different, how it is different. Buddhism in Cambodia.
In
Cambodia compared to Thailand and compared to Australia.
I think it's the same. The same is like... The same? Yeah, the same. Yes. But Buddhism in the Chinese and... Japan is Mahayana, is a different like that, Mahayana and Theravada.
We got 10 minutes, maybe you can wrap it up, eh?
I come here to have a lot of questions, but in my temple, I keep quiet.
Go on, ask him questions. He doesn't get the chance at all.
It's a nice question to ask.
There you go.
Why did you come to Australia?
Oh, that's good.
good question.
It's a good question. Yeah, it's the first time I come here because my friend, he lives in Queensland. He sponsored me to visit for holiday in Australia. But I travel around like that. First, I arrive Brisbane, then I go to Sydney, then to Adelaide. But here I know the president in like president of Cambodia. President? Yeah, president of community.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
She knows my grandmother in Cambodia. Yeah.
Tola.
Tola. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So the president of the Cambodian Society of WA. Yeah.
But when I come here, I have a good experience. Like when I come here, I stay in my temple maybe 2 days. And I went to Bodhijana to stay there for 2 weeks. when my English is not good, I can follow the some monk. They go to the Barnabas, go to Armstrong, and I follow him. But I can communicate with him. I can follow. But I know some. They good experience. Use yourself. Oh, the when I stay in the Bodhijana, first time I stay one week. But after that, I want to extend 1 week more, at 2 weeks.
But why did you decide to stay in Perth? Why did you decide to come back to Perth?
No. Your question is answered.
Oh, you can answer.
Yes. Yes, I think it's the first time in my temple. Have Cambodian monk, only one Cambodian monk. He went to Cambodia to study meditation. When I come here, during Cambodian New Year, no Cambodian monk for the ceremony. After that, the community invited me to stay here for Vasa, for rain retreat. I decided to help the community Cambodia. But I think it's why I stay here for a long time, because I saw the some Cambodian people. They is very kind. They want to set up the monastery for the everybody to meditate, because he know about the how to make the like the how to help the people, how to cure the mind, how to peaceful in Australia. And the goal like the my community to how to share the good for all the Austrian people, because last time all the Austrian people to support in my country and help to my country. Yes.
But there is a restriction, isn't there? During rain schedule you can't travel or do things, or is there a restriction? Is there any restrictions that you can't travel, or you can't do anything, sort of just meditate in rain?
No restrictions.
But the last year I went during rain retreat, I think I want to practice meditation. And I don't want to go to study English in Perth. But this year I asked Ajahn to allow me to study English in the Perth. Yeah, like Perth is like the, I study, the government give me the hour for 510 hours for free study English. I want to study there because I want to improve my English. But good, I can't wait.
What an interesting night.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Is it hard to look at people that have such materialistic things in their lives? Oh.
I don't think he understands that. Yeah, you gotta put it.
Is it hard for you to look at people with such materialistic things in their lives?
I know. Yeah. I know. I'm just thinking about it. It's an interesting question, but I think after a while, you just get used to your life as a monk, and you know that you're only allowed to have a certain amount of things. So when you see somebody like driving a flash car, or they have a really nice haircut, you don't really care anymore, because you're not a part of that life. You're sort of like separated from it, and you get used to it. And in a sense, that's sort of like just limits the mind from having too much craving, from chasing ideas and chasing, you know, material things, and that really does help with you know, calming the mind down and becoming peaceful. Yeah. Any more questions for Sukha Kamo? No.
With your brother just becoming a monk as well, you mentioned, will he try and get sponsorship to come to Australia as well?
But no, he's passed away.
No, he's passed away. I thought you said he was becoming a monk. Sorry. My apologies.
Yes. I don't think so. Honestly, you can sort of force them to do it, but you got to be careful because, like, I tell people, you got to be careful because they may develop a dislike for it, and when it comes time in their lives when they really need something to help them, and people give them the idea of the option of meditation. But because they've done something like that when they were young and they really disliked it, then they may not give it a chance when they're older. So I wouldn't recommend forcing it upon children, because children are children. You can't really force them, or you have to let them be. You know, you can take them to school and educate them and things like that. But when it comes to meditation, I think it's a very sensitive thing. And because I think meditation can offer so much to a human being in terms of, like, mental health and just lifting up your spirit and your energy levels and things like that. I don't think it's a good idea to mess around with it, to be honest. Yeah. Huh?
He thinks it's a sleeping clock.
What's that?
He thinks it's a sleeping clock.
Oh, your child. Yeah.
He actually wants to come here, but then I don't think it's for the right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and Like for example, the reasons why, like, a lot of us do meditate is because we've come across some sort of difficulty in life, or you know, we're depressed, we go see the doctor, the doctor says, oh, come here, and the monks will fix all your problems. Like, that's not true. You can't fix your problems, you gotta fix your own problems. But like for myself as well, it's not because I learnt how to meditate as a youngster, but it was because I was going through some sort of difficulty in life, and that's when I want to make some change, and meditation was an option. So then I tried it out, and then yeah, it sort of worked, and then you just continue doing it. And it's sort of like, you know, when I was like, when you're younger and your parents force you to do something, like, oh, you got to go to Sunday school, and they kind of hate it, you know, and they don't want to do it, and then they have a negativity towards it. And every Sunday when you send them to school, they're not happy. They just got a really long and sad face. And this is sort of the same thing when you're forcing kids to meditate. You can see that they're not happy. So why force them? I don't think that's the right thing to do, because you are conditioning them to dislike it. Yeah. So you got to be careful.
I have a 5-year-old and a 4-year-old. And,
yeah.
Over the past few months, I've been gently taking them through some very basic, just quiet times, I call it.
Yeah.
Where I get them to sit down and just take deep breaths, and particularly before they go to bed. And
yeah.
I'm not asking them to do anything like we would do here, but just to sit down and quiet themselves. Mm. And I've even talked to them about listening to the breathing, and it's actually been quite successful for them.
Mm-hmm.
But you can only do it in little.
Yeah.
But they sometimes they're in it and sometimes they're not.
You don't force it. You got to be sensitive and you know your child and how they are and if it's really helpful, then go for it. But I think at the same time, meditation can have just bring so much value and just enrich somebody's life, you know. Yeah. You don't want to sort of destroy something that precious. No. Yeah.
I do want it for the children. We rub our hands, put our hands like that for 1 minute.
Yeah.
Some of them can't even sit there for 1 minute.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And I went to teach kids, right? how to meditate in the Dhamma, and then, you know, you get a feeling that they don't really want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like kind of, yeah, kind of sad.
Yeah.
Okay. I think the cake's waiting.
Yeah.
What do you reckon?
Yeah.
Cake time. Good job. Good job, Sukha Kama.
Thank you, everybody.